this is Kat.
And this is Phoebe. Welcome to Feminine Chaos.
Welcome. I am trapped in my neighborhood right now, Phoebe, because a petroleum truck blew up and the world ended, as far as I'm concerned, here in Connecticut.
Right, because you shared a picture on Twitter of what looked like you were trying to report from the Middle East or Ukraine or something, but you said it was Connecticut, and I was a little, I'm not that far from Connecticut, I'm like, what's that? what was going on there?
No, I was actually, you know, as like mega transportation catastrophes go, this one, it went as well as things could go under the circumstances. You might be misled by the giant flaming fireball above the highway, which somebody crashed a petroleum truck, or I don't know. I didn't witness the inciting incident.
And was it politically motivated?
I think it was a mostly peaceful petroleum truck disaster. But this thing, something happened with this petroleum truck. It, you know, crashed or turned over or something right beside one of these walk bridges, and not just a walk bridge, cars go on it too, that crosses over I-95 that connects the northern part of Norwalk, where I live, from the southern part, and caught fire and proceeded to burn extravagantly. Honestly, it was just like, it was really pretty ostentatious for, I don't know, like an hour or something like that. And they had to shut down the entire highway. The funny thing is that this fire erupted not just under a bridge, but right next to the fire station. And I imagine the firemen who live in the fire station waking up and looking out the window and being like, so today work came to me.
They can work from home. They fire the hose straight from the, they can be on Zoom while putting the hose
right
out the window.
Multitasking. But yeah, so the upshot of this is that they had to close 95 several exits worth in both directions, which resulted in all of the cars being routed through Norwalk, which is not really made to accommodate this level of traffic, and especially not the part that I live in, which is this sort of like residential beachy area. And all of these poor motorists ended up getting just like crammed into this little warren of beachside streets over here where I live. And it would have been a good moment for some enterprising, like, young person or teenager to just go rolling down with a hot dog cart and some lemonade, because the traffic was backed up, like, for miles and miles. I've never seen anything like it. And I, meanwhile, was just like, I cannot go anywhere unless I can get there on foot, which is what I did all weekend long.
I picture you, like, walking into New York City with, like the sort of
the stick with the bandana. Yeah, like my hobo bag
hobo style.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I picture you like, oh, I have to go into New York today. I'm going to walk. Yeah.
Well, the train was still running. So, you know, okay. So there was that.
That ruins the image then.
No, picture me riding the rails. Picture me in a boxcar, like a little tattered, okay. You know, charcoal smudged on my face from somewhere, because that's just what hobos have. And my little hobo suit and my hobo bag, singing a railway song.
The hobo bag used to be actually a whole thing. Remember the hobo purse? I remember once spending a while trying to find a hobo bag, like for fashion, like that. It was a style of handbag.
Yeah, I still have one that I bought in the early 2000s at Macy's.
I don't know whatever happened to mine, because I think eventually I found one just like whatever street vendor or something. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, I would have understood what makes a bag a hobo bag. Isn't it like any bag can be a hobo bag if you try really hard and believed yourself to be a hobo?
I guess so. Just like a Birkin bag is if you try really hard to believe you're Jane Birkin.
Yes, which I am. Anyway.
Well, so this on this two Jane Birkins, what have we got on today on this two Jane Birkins podcast?
Two Birkins in a trench coat. we are talking about, for one thing, a very sexy movie that I recently saw. Not a sex movie, but a sexy movie. And then we're going to talk about a little bit about the protests, but not as such. Rather, we're going to talk about some of the discourse.
It's the discourse, as always. We are going to solve the Middle East as we do every week, and then move on to other things.
I feel like I should almost apologize to our listeners that, like, you know, it's like we're just covering what's kind of in the air, in the discourse, in the news. And unfortunately, since October 7th, that has mostly been stuff related to what's happening in the Middle East. So if somebody could kindly, like, start a major geopolitical conflict somewhere else in the world.
No, I mean, that's another question that we can, once we get past the sexy tennis topic, and I do not want to skip the sexy tennis. We're going to talk about the sexy tennis. But yeah, I'm not sure how much of it has to do with the Middle East, but we will. The sexy tennis, does that have anything to do with the Middle East, or is it happening elsewhere?
Let's see.
So you wrote your Unheard column about the movie Challengers.
Yes.
And I really want to see, I mean, not entirely about the movie, but it sounds, I've seen the trailer of this movie, and it seems to be, can you correct me if I'm wrong? There's some woman in it, and then there's two attractive men, and they perform for her together, as it were. And it sounds interesting. Is that right?
You know, despite being sort of wrong on the details, you are directionally correct about the entire theme of this movie, which is amazing because you have not seen it. Right.
I have seen the trailer. The trailer.
So, yes, this is I was trying to think, like, can we tie this in some way to the Middle East? Well, if you think about it, like, in a kind of a galaxy brained way, tennis and the Israel Gaza conflict. No, I'm just kidding. They're, you know, this is much sexier than anything that's happening in Gaza right now. So this movie is about two young men who as teenagers are friends, partners in tennis, and also competitors. So they play with each other. They also play against each other.
They play with each other.
They play with each other.
I'm here. Yeah. Go mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm.
And they embark upon, or they get embroiled in a love triangle of sorts with a woman named
Zendaya.
Yeah, but she's played by Zendaya, Tashi Duncan. Her name in the movie is Tashi Duncan, and she is Tashi is a tennis player also, who has a sort of, it's like her whole life is tennis, and tennis is her lens through which she understands everything. And the whole idea is that tennis is not really a game and not really a sport. It's a relationship. It's a metaphor for everything that can happen between two people. And the movie kind of unfolds from that premise. And what's interesting about this movie is it's by Luca Guadagnino, who also directed Call Me By Your Name. So no stranger to eroticism on screen. I think it's kind of like his bag, baby, is to make these sort of erotic films. Call Me By Your Name is, of course, famous for being the film in which, among other things, Timothée Chalamet fucks a peach. But this movie is all about sex and yet contains no actual sex scenes, which I am absolutely fascinated by. It's like one of the most erotically charged films I've seen in recent memory. But nobody is ever actually naked in it, which just strikes me as incredibly hard to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you wrote was so interesting. And it's also just like, I mean, Kat's article is so funny. Listeners, you want to go read it? Just as like, I cannot do it justice describing it. Just like, trust me, you want to go read it. But that just like what you get into is also just this difference between like porn. You can just like see anything sexual on a screen if you want to, or as versus like a movie that has some kind of erotic quality to it, that's talking, a movie that's covering sex as a topic in some capacity, that aspect of the human experience. And that's just a different thing. And in a way, the fact that you can see anything you want to see opens up different, maybe artistic possibilities. So it's not just about like how much sex is seen in a movie, what, how sexy it is. There's other stuff.
Yes. And I mean, how sexy a movie is not necessarily directly correlated with how much sex is actually shown on screen.
Like, exactly.
I find this movie to be much sexier, I think, than probably the majority of actual pornography, because so much is left to the imagination. And I'm trying to think like how, you know, at what length do I want to discuss this movie? Because really people should just go see it. It's just fun, and it's original, and it's grown up in its sensibilities in a way that just feels incredibly refreshing after what feels like 5 million years of Marvel superhero fare at theaters. But like, so a big mm-hmm. thing that is happening right now amongst, well, like in the discourse, and especially amongst younger people, like younger millennials and Gen Zs, is when they're surveyed about this, they'll say that they think sex and romance are, quote, overused in in film and in storytelling.
Okay, can I tell you something about this that I'm sure I've said on the podcast before, but it never gets old, that relates to what you just said? It's really important to say it here.
Yes.
Okay. In high school, very few people — I went to high school, this was math and science high school — very few had had sex in high school. That was very unusual at this school. But one kid had, and this was not, I'm not even talking senior year, this was like earlier on, but he came back after the weekend when this had happened and announced to his classmates that he had learned that sex is overrated. And I think about this all the time. Like, I can't even.
Yeah. That's amazing. This in turn reminds me of the movie Big, which I recently watched on an airplane, where, you know, it's if you haven't seen this one, or I mean, listeners, if you haven't seen it, it's Tom Hanks playing a 12-year-old who is not reincarnated, transformed overnight into an adult man, and, you know, and hijinks ensue. But there's this scene where, you know, he has to wait a while. He has to wait like 6 weeks before he is able to be transformed back into the 12-year-old or 13-year-old boy that he is. And so in the meantime, he like manages to get a job and gets involved with a woman. And so he, you know, has sex for the first time, and they don't show it on screen, but they show him the beginning of things. You know, they begin to kiss, then it fades to black. Then they show him coming to work the next morning, just like high-fiving everyone. He's, you know, he does not think that sex is overrated. He has discovered the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it's very entertaining. But anyway, yeah, I think it's very funny that, like, I don't know, and I think that this is a function of living in a world where there is so much pornography so widely available. Like, you can just literally at the, you know, the tap of your finger watch two people literally having intercourse, you know, in as much like graphic detail as you care to. And that this has led a lot of younger people to imagine that there's sort of no room for any other type of sexual content in art, that it's all, it's like porn or it's nothing. And I really appreciate that Challengers is, for lack of a better word, a challenge to that idea. It basically shows that sex can be a subject for art. It can be kind of not just like an element of storytelling. It can be the story. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're showing anything all that explicit. And yet it can be incredibly like titillating. The tennis scenes in this movie, in which a ball is being smashed by two grunting men, and you see their like, they're often filmed from the waist down, so you just see their like thighs kind of glistening as they run back and forth smashing this ball and grunting.
If you don't hear me for a while, I have gone out to go watch this movie and Kat will just be speaking and I will be in a movie theater near you.
See, I mean, if you can, try to replicate my experience of seeing it completely by yourself on a Wednesday afternoon, when you buy your ticket and getting looked at askance by the ticket taker, who's like, "Are you sure you're here to see this movie all by yourself, lady? Like, what you doing?"
Yeah, everybody really needs to read your article, because there are some moments in it that I like screamed kind of.
I'm so happy to hear that.
I don't want to spoil them is the problem. It harkens back to various moments and before online pornography was at all available.
Yeah, a little trip down memory lane to when, you know, when pornography was like something you had to kind of hunt for. And also, just to segue into our next topic, mm-hmm. when we did in fact view people over the age of 18 as adults capable of engaging in sexual relationships and also all other various and sundry manner of consequence inciting activities. Does this get us to our next topic?
I believe that we can move ahead to that very next topic that we were talking about. Yes.
Okay, so, good, because I'm getting a little hot and bothered talking about these men's thighs.
Okay. I mean, sorry, just one more thing though on that though. it's just so funny to me because I don't consume a lot of like recent pop culture, and I watch, as you know, like a lot of sitcoms, and now I'm watching even more because like I'm writing about them for this book and other stuff. So that the idea that you would have to even like justify, not you, Cap, but that one would have to justify sort of innuendo or stuff, that's like, it's all you get in like the 70s, you know? It's just, it's funny to think of that as something that would be like the exception and not just sort of entertainment and things that work on different levels for different audiences and that are like shockingly explicit if you're a grown up watching it, and that children would have no idea what that's about because it's all verbal. And and also just, sorry, this is like going to be a little digressive, but just like, I love on sitcoms when there's a lot of off screen action and like when the characters are telling stories about things that happened, not where they're not on the set, you mm-hmm. know? And I feel like that's similar, and that something that doesn't really fit with today's audience's expectation of both that like everything depicted is an endorsement, but also just this sort of, it's all just too literal. I don't know. I'm not really making sense, but my point is I want to go see this movie. It sounds good. But speaking of young people with strapping thighs, there are all these encampments at universities now, and they are ostensibly for Palestine. Strapping the thighs for Palestine. I have some questions, which are, among them, if the ostensible goal of the encampments is for universities to divest from Israel, one question, I know we've talked about this before, one question I have is, until a certain point or just indefinitely and all of this? I'm going to set all of that aside and just, we're talking about who are the protesters in terms of age, and not, we have not surveyed them. We are not the Pew Center or the Gallup Center, or we're not pewing or galloping around. We are some podcasters, and I am fascinated by the discourse about the age of the students on two levels. Okay. Can I try to sum up the two levels?
Yes, please do.
Okay. So one level is, should one disregard the protests? Either disregard them because it's little children protesting, or take them seriously because the children are our future and the children are pure and they're our only hope and they know better than the grown-ups. But the point is, everybody commenting on this seems to agree that it's extremely important that these are these little babies who are out there protesting.
Can you cite some examples of the protesters are mere children discourse? Because I'm not sure I've seen this.
I can. Okay, so this is all going to be, by the time you are hearing this, you will be reading about it in the Canadian Jewish News in my Monday column. So one came up actually on on the Bonjour High podcast, which is the other podcast I'm a co-host of, last week, where we had the journalist Justin Ling on, a Canadian journalist, talking about the Columbia protests, and he reported from them in person and all of this. So he was describing the campus as kind of like, that he thinks of college as like a sandbox for students to, you know, explore different ideas and figure out their own politics and so forth. And he uses the word sandbox. And on the podcast, I pushed back against this and was like, as somebody who is often in a sandbox with actual children, I have trouble thinking of these as, you know, children, right? But then another writer, Shalom Auslander, had on Persuasion, and these are both linked to in that article, and that we can get it all in some perhaps more efficient form in the show notes, but where he was saying that you should think of the protesters as children because he has an 18-year-old and his 18-year-old is just a child and the brain isn't fully formed. You know, people aren't quite, I need to find the exact quote though, because it's this article called "Dear Media, Stop Taking Students Too Seriously." And I'm trying to search for the word testicles, and then I'm getting like that
as one does.
And then I suddenly see this is going to seem really ridiculous, but suddenly I see Yasha Mook's face because it's on Persuasion as I try to hit Command F to find. Okay, so here I found the testicles. Okay, so he writes, as the National Institute for Mental Health puts it in layman's terms, the brain finishes developing and maturing in the mid late 20s. Okay, blah blah blah. And then he continues, in even laymanier terms, they're literally half-baked. Their batter is sticking to the toothpick. Their emotional testicles have not yet descended.
Oh, I just, on top of everything, the juxtaposition of toothpick and testicles, too close, very dangerous. Even rhetorically, I don't think these things belong together.
Isn't that a little bit much?
You stick the toothpick into the testicles; it comes out covered in batter.
Yes, you don't want to put any toothpicks, even in the most theoretical...
Theoretical testicle.
So those are two examples. I have also just seen in general the take that like you should let the students do their student thing. I have seen this both in the sense of... Oh, wait, and sorry, there was one more concrete example that I wanted to give, which was, and this will come up in the other angle, that's not the they are children, but somebody who's a professor at the University of Toronto walked around at the encampments there, and somebody named N Dipper for Life, three Canadian flags, put on Twitter, imagine having the time of day to walk around and annoy the students who are protesting a genocide. A grown man doing this. He says he is an associate professor. An associate professor explains why he has the time. Get a real job and leave the kids alone. Okay. So there's that, but there's also just been a lot of like sort of praise about, you know, like just in the mainstream media of like the student protest tradition, like that it matters so much that these are students, that these are kids who care about other kids. They care about the kids in Gaza because they're the kids in America or in Canada or whatever. So there's been a lot of emphasis on how important it is that they are youth, right? Yeah. Have you seen some of this?
Yes, I have.
So you get it both from the people dismissing them, but also from the people who are saying that that's what makes them so pure. But that, now I am going to just have to jump to the other angle. And I know I've been talking for a while, I want to not hear my own voice. But this professor did indeed go around, and I have to just get what his name is in front of me, because otherwise this makes no sense. Kevin A. Bryan. He is A. Bryan, who is an associate professor, indeed, of strategic management at, I guess, the Rotman's, I think that's a business school.
This is the one who had the audacity to walk around engaging with students. How does he even have the time as a professor?
Yes. So, yes. So what happened here was he, okay, this is really funny. Okay, he has a whole thread about it, and then it sort of wraps up with, oh, last thing, to make as clear as possible that this isn't a student protest and shouldn't be called as such, I am 40, and no one batted an eye about my age when I was there. Important to get this right. And then he adds all these Canadian media companies. So there's the question of, are 20-year-olds children? But there's also the question of, are the 20-year-olds 20-year-olds? Because it all, who cares if the brain stops developing or starts developing or whatever it develops, if the protesters are not, in fact, traditional age college. And then, okay, but the best, sorry, just one other piece that I just have to say is I got pushback from this, from somebody saying, students can be any age. I'm 55 and I'm in a PhD program. I'm like, okay, I am happy for you, but that is not the point.
Yes, that's anyway. The exception that proves the rule, I guess. That's not who anybody is picturing when they're talking about this stuff. And so, okay, I think that there's an element here that I remember being present to a certain extent also in the summer of 2020. Do you remember when those two lawyers in New York City like firebombed a police car and then...
The children, right. Yes.
I mean, they were lawyers in their 20s, but then they were arrested. And then all of a sudden it was like, they're just passionate kids. Like, you know, let them have their Molotov cocktail, you know, or mocktail. You know, they're not old enough to drink. But there's like this bizarre, like trying to kind of have it both ways thing where on the one hand, we're supposed to be taking the students, the protesters very seriously because they are so young. And that means they are like so pure. They have yet to be corrupted by the world. They have yet to indulge in the kind of jaded and magical thinking that plagues the adults among us who can no longer see things clearly. But also, they're just kids. Like, oh, let them. And don't take it too seriously. Like, they're just making mistakes. Their brains aren't even fully formed. Like, yes. I feel like you do have to pick one of these things. And I also feel like too many people are trying to have it both ways with this. But there's also just the idea that we need to be sort of like endlessly indulgent of anybody whose brain has yet to fully develop. Hence, like, you know, we need to treat people like they're literally children and not responsible.
And that's somehow good for them. I mean, I'm sorry, this is the part... Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but yes. I mean, just to like... It's not as though... your brain develops until you're 27, and then it crystallizes and you're done. Like, development is like, it's a lifelong thing. Like, yeah, nobody is the same person at 15 that they were at 5, or at 30 that they were at 15, or at 50 that they were at 30. Like, people are in a constant state of development, whether it's your frontal lobe doing things, or your memory doing things, or your personality crystallizing, or then destabilizing in certain ways. Like, nobody is static throughout their lives, and it's not as though you reach this magic Rubicon that you cross over where, like, okay, all of a sudden now you're done and you can be held accountable for things like forever for the rest of your life, because your brain is just like, it's fully baked and it's fully intact and it's set in stone now. I don't know, like, not to go too far down the rabbit hole here, but eventually people start to develop, like, age-related cognitive difficulties. Their brains literally start to disintegrate. It's like the batter's not sticking to the sides of the bowl anymore, but, like, the baked thing is developing cracks and holes and fissures in it. I don't know. The point is, like, I just kind of reject this as a way of understanding how we should and shouldn't determine whether people are capable of bearing responsibility for their actions, especially when their actions, and I'm sorry, I know I'm talking a lot here, but, like, their actions are specifically designed on a model of civil disobedience, where the entire point is you disobey and there are stakes. You disobey and there are going to be consequences. And the reason you disobey, yes, is because the point is the consequences are worth the statement that you're making. When you start to argue, like, no, there shouldn't be consequences because these are mere children, then you cannot say that and also still maintain that the action itself, the disobedience itself, carries the same weight and the same heft. It just doesn't work.
Oh my goodness. So many things here. Okay. So yes, and it's making me think of the whole masked protesting, but also the anonymous open letter phenomenon.
Yes. Oh my goodness. You know, yes, what I mean?
Because it's very much like, I'm going to take a brave stand, but nobody can know who I am and it can't harm my prospects in any way. And the university, like, it's as if it's doing protest as an extracurricular. You know what I mean? Like, they seem to want this pat on the back from the university as versus, yeah, anyway. All of that, yes. I just want to, like, talk about a kind of different branch from it, which is the whole is campus a sacred space angle. So there's, to just, like, leap into it, I mean, there's the whole class angle, which, while I did bring it up first, of course, Rob Henderson also brought it up on Twitter because it's extremely his beat.
But you're in a feud with him now.
Now, you know, and now, no, I'm in a, no, he and I are in a polyamorous triad, several tennis players. I am kidding. I have never met this person. But what I was going to say, if I can stop thinking about the tennis players, is that basically, obviously nobody thinks that a 20-year-old is a child unless this 20-year-old is a student. And where this becomes really obvious is that when a 27-year-old is a student, that person is a little child. This came up with a Me Too story. Was it some writer who had kissed a fresh-faced 26-year-old grad student?
Oh, I was a wide-eyed 26-year-old. Yes, this was the Juno Diaz. Juno Diaz kissed her on the cheek, by the way. Every time we mention this, I have to mention that.
Yes, kissed her on the cheek. And it was a non-story. Yes, it was a not, yes, it was a, it turned out, it was like a really, really awful case of, it was an overreach story, not a, I know we've been requested to talk about Harvey Weinstein. I don't think I have anything to say about Harvey Weinstein, but I will say that I think 26-year-olds are grown-ups. And I also think 20-year-olds are grown-ups, but I definitely think 26-year-olds are grown-ups. And this came up then, also, that the New York Times coverage of the Columbia protest found that the average age of an arrested student protester was 27. And then there was also some interview in a different article about, like, the student protesters that interviews a 25-year-old faculty member as if this is, like, one of the student protesters. And it just seems like the definition of student, if you have a certain, if you come across, like, social class wise, whichever markers wise, proximity to a university physically wise, as somehow student-y, you're a child when you're any age, right? If you're enrolled in a course, or you might be enrolled in a course, or if you're a professor who feels in your heart of hearts, akin to like a, if you were a teenager in May 1968, whatever, then you're a student and you're a little baby. Whereas if you are, you know, not on, have, if you have nothing to do with a university or a college and you're 18, 19, 20, you're a grown up, a regular grown up. And that seems not great. But the question is, who is it not great for? And I think primarily, in a sense, for the supposedly privileged set who then have to deal with like campus police instead of police, which I think is its own problem.
Yeah.
But that's a separate issue that we'll deal with, we'll address separately.
I think it's bad for everyone. It's, I mean, it seems like this is a situation in which nobody wins, or, you know, or if they do win, it's like, what is that called? A Pyrrhic victory where actually like something bad is happening to them. They just don't realize it right now. But I have something to say about this that is like, it's uncharitable, but I don't think it's inaccurate. And so I'm just going to go for it. The kind of vibe surrounding these protests and the way that people who are in positions of leadership talk about them, and even the way that like people who are adults, people who are professors talk about them and talk about the people who are engaged in them, it does come off like they think this is a daycare. Or if not a daycare, then like a sort of an eighth grade dance scenario where everyone is showing up to like, you know, there are chaperones and there are snacks and it's going to be nice and safe. And we're going to kind of like, we're going to experiment. We're going to like cosplay a little bit as doing something adult. You know, like maybe we're going to touch each other's butts a little bit on the dance floor, but in like a safe and, and supervised way. And then at the end of the day, everyone will go home and hopefully we all learned something today and like, and nobody got hurt and nobody had to deal. It's like you cosplay as an adult and then you go home at the end of the day and sleep safe and warm in your bed with a glass of milk like a little child. And this is overstating it, but only barely. Like, I mean, there has been this emphasis on the protesters want, like, they want snacks, they want catered food, they want a hot lunch. And it's this idea that, like, I should be able to do this, but I should also be able to do it and, like, enabled in doing it by some institutional authority figure in the utmost comfort without having to actually not only risk anything, like, you know, the stakes apparently are not supposed to be the typical stakes of civil disobedience anymore. Like, you're not supposed to be risking arrest or expulsion or suspension by doing this. But also, you're not even supposed to be uncomfortable.
Well, what's interesting is I think that, I mean, to yes and this, I think the college's own role in all of this is huge. And you have to look at the material aspect of this. College is insanely expensive, right? Private schools, especially, even public schools, expensive these days. But these private schools are massively, massively expensive. No, not everybody is paying the ticket price, but everybody is seeing that price and having to figure out how to get around it. You know what I mean? Like it's, and some people are paying it, right? And some people's families are paying it and then donating a wing, whatever. The point is, yes, these colleges are really expensive. And what that does is it makes it so that whereas in the past, you could put yourself through college. Today, that's very, very difficult at a regular four-year college, especially at one of these really expensive ones. Although in some sense, no, because it depends what kind of funding they have for scholarships. But the point is the infantilization happens just on that material level that everybody is a dependent when they're in college in a way that was not the case when you could just more easily go to a college that was, you know, freer, that you're close enough and have a job and just be, you know, a young person out on your own. Right. So that's part of it.
I think that's a very good point. It does give the entire thing a sort of like extended summer camp vibe, right?
Right. But I'm emphasizing that I don't think that this is necessarily that the people themselves who are doing this are now this is where it gets complicated. When you're talking about grad students, no, if these are PhD students at somewhere like Columbia, they are paid. They are people with a salary.
They're camp counselors. They're the summer camp counselors.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're TAs, right? So I guess in that sense. But there is just something about the way universities are structured and also the holistic admissions and this whole idea that you are on this, in this community of these where nothing bad is ever supposed to happen. All of this is coming from the schools. It's something the schools promise. So it's not just like, I know people have been pointing out that the schools, you know, make a big deal about their history and activism and so forth, but it's more than that. It's that they, you know, they promise that it's going to be this special time.
Yes.
And I think that that also gets at not just the student protesters, but why protesters who have nothing to do with students or any of this join up on a campus. Why have a student protest where there are no students, which initially is what it looked like at the University of Toronto, because there was this amazing statement put out by the university that said something like, you know, we've tried to contact a student representative and they haven't sent us anybody, so we just don't know that these even are students. And I guess eventually some student did get in touch. But like, yeah, I mean, who knows how many are actually students? And I think that that's important, not insofar as like deciding how it is to walk through a space. Like, I think, well, I do think so. I used to think that this was going to affect like individual schools' reputations. Columbia's maybe. I think this is happening too many places for it to really matter now. Like, I don't, you're not going to not go to this one because the other one had the same thing. But I do think there's just something interesting about, like, I think it carries over even to people who aren't literally students, that they feel like this, the school is this sort of cocooned environment, and the colleges themselves are selling that, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I'm trying to remember whose essay it was that made this point. It's not an original thought to me. It might have been John McWhorter's piece on it. Something about how the students, like college students in general, there is this very intense feeling that they are, yeah, like you said, dependents, and that the colleges are stepping into a parent role. They're not just being housed, they're being sheltered, they're being cared for.
Oh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that there's this expectation, yeah, that the college experience is going to be this sort of bubble, and that the college itself is going to take this parental role. And what I'm thinking of specifically is, so I guess maybe it was in the New York Post at one point, they did some profiles of some of the kids at Columbia who did get arrested. And what they found was one of them had a previous record, like she had been responsible for a texting while driving accident that killed two elderly people. And she was underage at the time, and she was like, you know, 16, 17 years old. And she ended up getting off with like some kind of, I don't know, non-moving violation and a $200 fine, because her family was very wealthy and was able to hire really good lawyers. And she was able to plead guilty to like a much lesser offense than what she actually did, which is, you know, like vehicular manslaughter. And that's obviously a really extreme example, but it does kind of paint a picture of what, you know, if you are a certain type of person from a certain type of background and you do something wrong, that you may expect that you're going to be shielded from the consequences of what you did in a certain way, you know, because your family has the resources to do that. And that kids who come from a background like that, in some cases, are expecting their colleges to then take the same role.
Yeah. Oh, that story was, yeah, I mean, it was quite
something. That was really upsetting.
But I think I figured out, though, what the original feminine chaos angle on all of this is.
Okay.
It's like, I don't think I've seen this anywhere
Do
else.
Tell.
And I think this is going to be extremely us. So a lot of people are connecting the protests to 2020 and the, you know, BLM protests and all of this. But I think that this actually connects much more to Me Too and to the whole infantilization era, to the, you know, children of who are 30 years old, but they're children because reasons. And also specifically to this idea that things that happen on a campus are different. And this is even pre-Me Too, but like the whole sort of Title IX Obama era thing of like campus sexual assault is a thing that's somehow separate from regular people sexual assault. And if it happens on a campus, it's this. And if it happens off of a campus, who cares? Does that make sense?
Yes,
you see,
I do.
So, and what I guess what I personally find a little bit ridiculous about this is I don't actually think universities are better than other authorities at dealing with that sort of thing. But then there's also just like, but it's just interesting how it seems to, like, I see a thread from that almost more than from the more recent sort of wokeness wars or whatever, like just this whole idea that there's, that these campuses are these pure spaces, which is just extremely hypocritical. Like talk about, we are going to talk about hypocrisy also as its own little segment, but I think there's just something about the sort of the feminism of that moment kind of resurfacing, not in terms of feminism, although a lot of the protesters are indeed women.
I was going to say these protests skew so heavily female. There are so many young women, and like it's interesting too because there is this kind of photogenic aspect to it, where you know you've got it's like. You have the keffiyeh as fashion accessory. It feels in certain ways like a party atmosphere at these things. Which I don't think that's necessarily always bad, but it does speak to who's in attendance and what they're getting out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to digress about those photos, although I am obsessed with this, where there were these photos, and I blogged about this, whatever, where it looked at the University of Mississippi as if there was one young woman of color standing against, like, up opposing a wall of frat boys. And then a different photograph shows that these are just a protest and a counter-protest. I don't want to digress about that, but I am obsessed with it. But I wanted to just talk for a moment about this thing with the professors and the roles they're taking, because I have seen a bunch of professors take stands on this, and a lot of them are, you know, actually physically at these protests as well, like defending their students, right? That's what they say, that they're going to defend, the professors are going to defend the students, like stand between the students and the cops, and then it's like a bigger deal if a professor gets arrested than if a regular human being does, apparently. But also, I've also seen professors, though, on the other side saying that, which is kind of our segue into our next topic, but just that professor's saying like, no, this is ridiculous. I want it to stop. Or this is ridiculous. The people in the encampments are idiots, or just something more nuanced or whatever. But professors are taking a stand. And I'm just wondering what it would be if you're in college now and you know that your professor is either like, as some are, I think, like holding class from the encampment or, you know, whatever. Like, I just, when I was in college 1,000 years ago, there was a norm that professors didn't deal with student affairs. It's not that professors couldn't have their own politics, obviously they could, but that if it was specifically like student business was student business, and there was a norm that a professor would talk about what students are doing if to, for example, praise their student, won a nice scholarship, they could like post on Facebook about that and nobody's going to be like, oh no, you violated the norm. No, but like you wouldn't be criticizing students publicly, and you wouldn't be praising certain student political act, you know? Mm-hmm. And that seems gone. And I have some feelings.
Yeah. What are your feelings?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it would suck to be one of these college students now, whatever your views on this topic, although, I mean, I have thoughts about which would be harder. But imagine submitting an essay that had the wrong politics. Is there even the pretense that it's going to be judged on the basis of its quality of argumentation and citation and whatnot? Or is it all just being written by ChatGPT anyway, so who cares? I mean, I don't know.
Or, I mean, are they even asking them to submit essays? I've seen that in some cases they're just saying, like, you know what, it's fine, we're just disbanding, you all get an A, which, you know. But it's, you know, what's also interesting about this, like, it's tangentially related, not explicitly about the professors taking a political stand, but just something that that I've been thinking about and that I've seen other people writing about, is like when things devolve this way on campus, it ends up catering to a very particular type of student who is, I think, actually a relatively narrow swath of the student population at the expense of all the other ones. And I'm thinking specifically of not just the student who wants to be able to like engage with the course material and turn in an essay, you know, without having to worry that their politics are not the same as the professor's politics. And, oh no, like, what does this mean? Am I going to be graded fairly? But things like, you know, like graduations getting canceled or like classes being held in the encampment, which is like, it's not just what if you're on the other side of this politically, it's what if you don't want your entire education to be about this? Like, what if you're at school to engage with a different area of study? Or what if you're there because you want to have like a normal college social experience that is not overtaken by strident politics? I do kind of feel bad for all of the kids who are, yes, adults, but who just wanted to, like, in these last last few beautiful spring weeks on campus, especially if they're graduating seniors, like hang out on the quad, have a beer with their friends.
Sorry, but like after COVID, this is like, that's the thing. It's that's what, I mean, I just keep thinking about how so much of these, like these students, they were, I mean, apparently Saturday Night Live had some segment about this, but like, yeah, I mean, you just think about like, imagine online classes after COVID, right?
Yeah. And also like where, you know, it's the, there's sort of one mode, one socially sanctioned mode in which you can like be out and be engaged and like, you know, and be gathering. And it's political protest. And it's like, you get the sense that there's all of this institutional support for this one thing. And none of the other ways in which people might joyfully connect with each other, none of the other reasons why they might do this, receive any grace from the campus institutionally at all. I was reading, I think it was in Tablet, about...
I was going to say, are you subtweeting that Tablet
article? Yeah, I am verbally subtweeting that Tablet article where, yeah, you know, like all of... But it's not just that. There's all of this stuff and it's not even... It doesn't even date to these protests. It actually goes back further, I think, at least to the start of COVID and probably before that, where in the name of sensitivity and inclusion, a lot of things that used to be like fun, but in a sort of an edgy way about the college experience have had their edges blunted or have been eliminated or have been canceled because like, what if one person gets offended? We need to make sure that we're a safe space, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, the campus experience becomes kind of blandified in all of these very important ways. And then having kind of eliminated that aspect of the college experience, you put it back just in this one very explicitly political way that only a tiny, tiny handful of students are going to derive any satisfaction from. And I don't know, I think it changes the nature of college as a place to live, you know, to have formative experiences. It seems like a bummer.
Yeah. I mean, I guess some people have been saying like, this is going to be the winners here will be colleges in the South or colleges, where this is less of a thing. I don't know.
I think the colleges that go out of their way to preserve this sort of more irreverent and like not political, but spirit of fun, are gonna emerge as places where people gravitate to over ones that seem like a place where you're only gonna have fun if your idea of fun is like banging on a drum and chanting for whatever the cause du jour is.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I could just go on and on and on.
But let's segue. Yes. So Phoebe, I want to know how many times have you personally masturbated to the idea of the police bashing in the skulls of protesters with a baton? Is it more than 5, more than 10? Is it too many to count?
I can't answer that question because I am too busy right now engaged in what you describe. So for some reason, this Harper's letter is going to follow us. Kat, this is going to follow us our whole lives. I did not know what this thing was. I was like a home with a baby. I did not know. I got something very flattering saying you wrote a book, telling me that I had written a book that had like resonated with somebody. I was like, oh my God, somebody, there's a person, one, you know, in the parentheses, the number written out, one person has read my book. I'm so excited to learn about this. And do I want to sign this thing that relates to the topic? And I was like, okay, I'll look at it. And I looked at it and it seemed like everything it said seemed reasonable. It was also at a very specific political moment, right? The Harper's letter. And I want to talk about that too. But anyway, this Harper's letter for open whatever.
On free speech and open debate.
Thank you. Because it's not the cancel culture letter, even though people always called it that.
No, it doesn't say cancel culture anywhere.
Cancel culture anywhere. But basically, if you signed the Harper's letter.
As we both did.
All you hear about for years is this whole thing about the Harper's letter signatories. Now, I'm going to break something upsetting to you, which is I don't think they ever mean us. They definitely don't mean me. Maybe they mean you a bit, but I think they basically mean a few like extremely famous people on it, I think, because it had like some very famous people on it, which I did not know. One could not know this beforehand.
That's right. That's right. How many? I mean, I think I was told one or two names when I was invited to sign it. It was like, you know, here's an example of like to just describe the kind of the breadth of people who were going to be putting their names to this, to understand that it wasn't being signed just by kooks and cranks, which I appreciated.
So was I, but they were like serious. They were like serious scholars or something. I did not get the sense that this was like famous people.
I heard about Noam Chomsky and Wynton Marsalis, and I was like, you know what?
I think I did too. That sounds familiar.
But there are literally hundreds of names on this letter, aren't there? Or a hundred?
I think it's, let's look this up. There were 153, yeah. It says. So, yeah, I mean, but like what happens now whenever there's, so the Harper's letter, I just want to say, like, it came out of a specific moment when what's called wokeness or whatever you want to call it was kind of at a fever pitch,
yes,
right?
Yes, I mean, keep it in mind, this is when Alison Roman was being canceled because she called Marie Kondo a sellout, and apparently, even though she was, but apparently this was more than could be borne.
Yeah, so this was that era of, that would soon be followed by, or I guess was already the beginning of, like, the influencers doing the tearful apologies and promising to do better, Robin DiAngelo, it was that cultural climate, okay? That was where that was coming out of. We are in a very, very different cultural climate now, and I can get into why, but the point is, the Harper's letter, I just want to say, I do not understand this to have been meant as like a timeless commentary meant to be applied as one would apply the Constitution, or if you're religious, the Bible, or whatever, to like all situations throughout time. I think it does speak to certain principles that are not about specific moment. I'm not saying it doesn't do that at all. But I do think that the idea that like how you felt about Alison Roman's cancellation would map out in some kind of very clumsy but apparently acceptable way onto how you would feel about things happening in 2024 that are very different. I don't think that was ever promised in that letter. I don't think I would have signed that letter, but that wasn't what it said. But you get what this is all a bit long-winded on my part, and I'm sorry. But the point is that basically you get a lot of people on the sort of pro-Palestinian side of things who will say, that the Harper's crowd, or sometimes also they will say the free speech crowd, but it's often about the Harper's letter specifically, is okay with people being fired for being pro-Palestinian, with people who attend a protest rally being arrested for doing so. And you get a lot of where are the Harper's letter signatories? Like, where are they? Why have they not yet spoken up? And you get, why are they all in now you've gotten, why are they all in favor of the police coming and violently arresting peaceful protesters? Mm-hmm. So there are like a lot of pieces here. But yeah, I mean, we'll pick this apart because there's a few different parts, but I've been talking too much and I don't want to keep talking.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like... I'm just trying to think how should we best frame this. I think what we're both responding to specifically is New York Times Magazine writer Jody Rosen, who I like as a writer in general, tweeted that, quote, an amazing number of Harper's letter signatories have come out against the campus protests. And then he wrote, I'm going to quote here, although both these tweets have been deleted, and we'll talk about that in a second too. He wrote, "We uphold the value of robust and even caustic counter speech from all quarters. It is now all too common to hear calls for swift and severe retribution in response to perceived transgressions of speech and thought." That's a quote from the Harper's letter. And he writes, signed, "A bunch of people who want riot cops to shut down protests." So I, because it was a rainy Sunday and I had a moment, replied to Rosen suggesting that he should really cite his sources on this if he's going to make an allegation like this of like the rankest hypocrisy that and he's quite explicit, you know, in these tweets about the idea that what he's seeing is people who were Harper's letter signatories now coming out against protests and saying they want the police to break them up, that people shouldn't be allowed to protest and they should be arrested for protesting violently, apparently. And we got into a little bit of a back and forth. And what I discovered, which I guess shouldn't surprise me, but it is nevertheless disappointing, is that we have reached a place now where this thing is happening. And I mean, you kind of always get this whenever somebody tries to talk about free speech. It's like, oh, you support free speech? Then you should be totally okay with, like, insert the most transgressive, insane, insulting thing here. Like, I'm just going to freely speak to a hitman about murdering your entire family. What, you're not okay with that? Like, that kind of thing. Where basically, because some of the Harper's Letter signatories, and that, I mean, this includes me, have written critically about some of the things that are happening at the protests, including, for instance, protesters making a human chain to force people off of public spaces because they perceive that these individuals are either in disagreement with them or they just look too Jewish or whatever it is. You know, that writing critically about this stuff signals that you are, in fact, a free speech hypocrite, which is just, I mean, do I even have to explain why that's a bonkers interpretation? Like, it doesn't make sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. Because, yes. So there's the, because there was something that I needed to find about. So there was a Caitlin Flanagan. This may be that it was about Caitlin Flanagan. In what seems to have been a bad joke, she was saying that the NYPD should arrest some professors. And it seemed like I don't know what she was trying to do there. And as her personal representative and proxy, it's weird I wasn't alerted. But okay. So somebody, Larissa Werniak, who is a legal historian and recovering lawyer. I hope she's recovered.
You can never recover from that. It's too late.
No. As a sort of, she was trying to paraphrase Nicholas Christakis. He had tweeted that he was for restraint in using police, but that he has denounced protesters who restrict movements of fellow students. Okay, anyway. So then she replied in quotes, but like as obviously a sort of paraphrase quotes, when I wasn't suggesting the protesters have mass psychogenic illness, I was defending them. Okay, so the argument seems to be that if you are coming out in favor of the protests, that's free speech. If you are criticizing the content of the protests, if you are calling the protesters ding-dongs, that is not free speech because it will be used as a justification to shut it all down. That seems to be one piece of the argument, which I find, I mean, it's sneaky and clever, but it's stupid and it doesn't actually add up.
It's clever but stupid. What if I am in favor of the protests because I'm in favor of protest generally, but I also think it is objectively true that these protesters, as do most protesters, as do most members of mass movements of any kind, do in fact exhibit signs of mass psychogenic illness. It's just like a common element. Like, I mean, where do I fit? Do I get to wear both hats for both teams?
You can wear only hats made of tinfoil. What I was going to say about this, so there's this other piece though, which seems to be retroactively making the Harper's Letter effectively an ACAB defund the police pro-anarchy letter, saying that if people are acting politically in ways that have nothing to do with what they're saying, but specifically if they are engaged in acts like, yeah, not letting people into buildings, or if they're breaking rules of their university, that's actually speech. And therefore, if you sign the Harper's Letter, you are basically that is a letter against there ever being police on a college campus, and that was what the letter was. And then you're a hypocrite if you, yeah. So there's that also. But what's interesting is it seems to be like the hypocrisy charge seems to go towards anybody who does not actively support the protests. And there just doesn't seem to be a lot of understanding that you can, you know, you're not a hypocrite on speech if you don't agree with what people are saying and you say that. That is just fighting speech with speech, and that's allowed. And that's if you're a professor, if professors are allowed to say they support the protests, they're allowed to say they oppose protests. I don't see how you get around that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess the takeaway here is just basically that, yeah, this Harper's Letter is going to be used as a cudgel with which to beat the signatories by people who did not like the letter in the first place for as long as we are all alive, which unfortunately is going to be for quite a few years. So I guess.
Well, I'm not planning to venture onto the University of Toronto campus immediately, so I might make it. Yeah. We never talked about the Bears, though. Oh my God, do we still have time? I realized I...
Oh, the Bear. Let's talk about that for our premium episode.
I think we will. So stay tuned and sign up for our premium episodes if you want to talk about bears of all
Yes,
kinds.
And in general, you know, now that we've teased something about bears, aren't you titillated? Aren't you enticed? If you've enjoyed this conversation and would like to hear more like it, we invite you to join us on our Substack as a paying subscriber at femchaospod.substack.com, where for $5 a month, you will receive access to 2 premium subscribers-only episodes of the podcast per month, as well as commenting privileges, open threads, and a community of erotic tennis players like nothing you've ever seen before in your entire life.
Couldn't have said it better.
Come smash with us on Substack. And has this been Feminine Chaos?
That it has.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining us.
Bye.
Goodbye.